polls reveal that the election is getting tighter, which means that the idea of a Trump presidency and a Trump immigration policy may become more likely than it appeared just a week or two ago. But many critics of Mr. Trump's wall say that it's not only unfeasible and unrealistic, but that it might also completely backfire. Eduardo Porter, who writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times, offered an alternative take on immigration policy in his October 26 column called A Framework for Managing Immigration, where he discussed the Bracero program and why it might be worth revisiting. I'm very pleased that Eduardo Porter could join us now. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. Can you talk a little bit about what the Bracero program was and how it got started?
Well, essentially, it was a large guest worker program that ran from the early 1940s till 1964. The idea was that there were labor shortages in American fields. The rationale related to the fact that there were many men going off to World War II. But however, of course, the program lasted until many, many years after the war had ended.
And what were American attitudes about immigration, especially from Mexico at the time?
Well, there's always been a mixed variety, a grab bag of attitudes about Mexicans. Clearly, the farmers that were bringing in Mexican labor believed that it was absolutely indispensable. And at the several occasions where there was a threat that this program might end, you would see the agricultural lobby or American farmers put a lot of pressure to keep the program open.
This is at the same time that many Americans were concerned about taking in Jewish refugees from Europe and more recently Syrian refugees today. The attitude about Mexican immigrants was different because it was seen totally in economic terms?
Well, I think so. And also because Mexico is the neighbor of the United States, there's a really long history of immigration by Mexicans to the United States under all sorts of guises, legal and illegal. An interesting statistic is that the Mexican-born share of the population in Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico was bigger in 1920 than it was in 1990 when we had this really large explosion of undocumented immigration.
So how did the Bracero program work? Did we go to Mexico to find people? Did Mexicans sign up for it?
Mexicans signed up for it with basically labor brokers, but it was an extremely shady sort of program. The Mexican government did not really participate very well, as it were, in kind of like policing. Nor did the American government, to be fair. So there was a lot of abuse going on in the program. But essentially, there were labor brokers, and they were meant to be regulated, and they were going to connect Mexican workers with American farmers. Then there would be also a system to retain part of the wages of these workers so that they would receive it when they returned to Mexico as an inducement for them to return. Of course, because this was really badly managed and very badly policed, a lot of this money simply vanished, and the workers just, you know, lost these wages.
They worked for free, in effect.
Well, or for very, very little money. Yes, and I mean, abuses were not only wage theft. Abuses related to their working conditions and to the health and the safety of the fields in which they were working. There were all sorts of abuses. And because the Bracero program tied workers to a single employer, so once they were here, they could not move to another job, that really kind of disempowered them. So they really had to stay put.
So with all this mismanagement, what was the upside for the program for Mexican immigrants or migrants?
Well, at the end of the day, I think that there was an economic incentive from subsistence farming in Mexico to a wage in the United States. And that logic has prevailed throughout decades, even though the working conditions in the United States were dismal by American standards, and there were all these abuses. I think that for many of the workers, it was still a good deal.
After you published the article, didn't you get a lot of reader feedback? What kinds of responses did you get?
Well, many people remember the Bracero program through all these abuses that we're talking about. And so there's a lot of mistrust of the idea that a guest worker program could be well managed. And so I got a lot of pushback about, you know, whether it would be a good idea to resuscitate this kind of program. Now, what I argue in my column is that the alternative to a program of guest workers like the Bracero program that we've seen over the last several decades has been undocumented immigration. And the conditions in which workers are treated under, you know, when they're outside of the legal framework is also pretty terrible. And so the question is, what's worse? And I'm positing that if you could improve on the Bracero program, if you could design a guest worker program that was better policed and so forth, it would be definitely better than what we've got right now, which is like millions of workers who have no protection under U.S. law because they have no legal right to work here.
Don't some researchers dispute that the Bracero program effectively ended illegal immigration while it was in place? Why is that point in dispute?
Well, for one, there's no real census of illegal immigrants in the United States. So we really don't have a long series of what illegal immigration numbers were, either the flow or the stock. But what we do have is kind of a proxy, and it's the Border Patrol's reports of apprehensions. And to my mind, the apprehensions do signal a very, very sharp decline in illegal immigration in the second decade of the Bracero program. So the Bracero program runs through the mid-40s through the mid-60s, but it had different incarnations with different numbers of workers that were allowed in. So in the first, say, decade, there was a very small quota of about 100,000, and that in the mid-50s was increased quite sharply to roughly 450,000. So just to show you kind of like the numbers, in 1954 you had 1 million apprehensions at the border. In 1953 you had 800,000 apprehensions at the border. By 1960 you're down to 22,000. So it's not zero, but it's quite a sharp decline.
I'm speaking with Eduardo Porter, who writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. His October 26 column was A Framework for Managing Immigration. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Where were most of the workers in the Bracero program going? What states?
Mostly California. California developed a very, very large agricultural economy, and still, right now, I think it's the salad bowl of the country. When a lot of the produce industry moved from New Jersey to California, so yes, it was California, but also some other border states, Texas, New Mexico.
Why was the Bracero program ended?
The Bracero program ended, I think, because there was this sense that it was depressing farm wages.
Wasn't Cesar Chavez opposed?
Oh, yes. There was strong pressure from American farm workers against the Bracero program. And because the claim was that it was really hurting wages, this influx of say, cheap labor from Mexico.
Go ahead.
No. And so the department eventually, the Department of Labor and the Department of Agriculture, I believe, decided to end the program.
Did the end of the program have much of an effect on the U.S. economy?
There's not like a ton of research on like the impact on the economy. There was some research done on the impact on the labor market because, of course, the claim was that this was affecting wages. And there was also the competing claim by farmers that if you ended the Bracero program, they'd have a worker shortages and, you know, their fields would go a fallow, or, you know, that it would be a disaster. There is a one... you know, pretty serious study done by a couple of economists at the University of the State of Louisiana, published in 1980 or so, that looked at this kind of carefully, looked at the 10 years before Bracero and the 10 years after the end of Bracero, and their conclusion was that neither of these things had happened, that there was no evidence that the ending of the program had created worker shortages or increased the farm wages. Now, to be fair, farm wages did rise in the 1960s. So there's, you know, the creation of the United Farm Workers and Cesar Chavez, and they get contracts with rising wages in the second half of the 60s. But an interesting thing to consider is that in states where there were no braceros, also farm wages rose. So the idea that this had to do with the ending of the Bracero program is much disputed.
So you felt that David Bacon was really missing the point when he wrote a letter that was critical of the story, saying that farm worker wages rose quickly after the end of the Bracero program?
Well, yes, I think that at the end of the day, it is incorrect. But I would also say that wages did rise. I mean, Cesar Chavez did get a contract for higher wages. I think the hourly wage for grapes pickers rose from about $1.25 to $1.75. So it's not untrue that wages rose. What I think is incorrect is to attribute this to the end of Bracero.
Do we know how many of these workers stayed in the United States? Did most of them go back to Mexico?
I don't have that statistic, actually. I know that many did remain. I mean, there's still like old braceros living in California today. You know, they're quite elderly now. So many did stay in the United States. But of course, many did return because there was this inducement of money on the way back. Then it, of course, did not happen. But at the beginning, there was this expectation that they would receive the rest of their wages when they returned.
What kinds of laws were put in place to deal with the flow of illegal immigration in the 70s and 80s after the Bracero program was ended?
Well, another important thing that happens in 1965 is a change in immigration law. And so one should also take that into account.
The Immigration Remember Control before and Reform Act?
No, that's 1986. I'm thinking 1965. Before 1965, immigration to the United States, there was a preference for Northern European immigrants and limits from immigration from pretty much everywhere else, especially Asia, Africa, Eastern Europe, Southern Europe. In 1965, because this is considered discriminatory, the immigration law changes and a quota is imposed on every country at 20,000 from no matter what country you're from. Now, this sounded like a good idea to end this kind of favoritism for white Northern European Christian immigrants, but it was also sort of unrealistic when you're thinking of a country that is sitting next door to you that has, you know, several tens of millions of people, many of which have been coming to the United States for a very long time. And so illegal immigration jumped quite markedly after 1965. And I would say that this had to do both with the end of the Bracero program and these very tight quotas imposed on Mexican immigration by the Immigration Act of 65. So illegal immigration rises quite sharply. So if you measure it by apprehensions, you know that by 1960 we were down to 22,000 apprehensions at the border. By 1974, we're at 620,000 again. So there's a quite sharp increase in illegal immigration from the mid-60s to the mid-80s. Doug Massey at Princeton estimates that 28 million people came in and some 23 million people went out, because a lot of this immigration was quite circular. People would come in and then leave after the job was done, so, you know, especially if you were in agriculture. And so there was a net increase of like 4.5 million undocumented immigrants between the mid-1960s and 1986. And that's when we had the next change in immigration law, which was IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, passed during the Reagan administration.
We hear a lot of people arguing that just like their forebears, new immigrants should apply and then just wait their turn.
Yeah, but the sense that...
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, carry on. No. I mean, it's that there's a sense that, you know, there's a line that one can wait in, but there is no line for Mexican immigrants or from immigrants from Guatemala or Honduras. I mean, there is really no legal pathway that will manage the kind of pressure to migrate to the United States. So the idea that they should wait in line is basically, well, wait in line and die in Mexico. Which, to people to want to come here desperately is not a reasonable proposition.
There seem to be two questions about the Bracero program which are still relevant today. Do programs that allow for legal immigration actually reduce illegal immigration? And do they bring down wages or take jobs away from Americans?
Yeah, well, those were essentially the two questions. And the evidence, sketchy as it is, suggests that illegal immigration did decline quite drastically during Bracero and then picked up quite sharply after Bracero was ended. The evidence on wages is, to my mind, also suggestive that the end of Bracero was not critical to the increase of farm wages. There were other things going on, such as the increasing in investment in mechanization in agriculture that would have the effect of raising wages and also reducing demand for labor in farms. So to my mind, those two questions are, you know, within the limits of the data that we have, answered favorably for a kind of a managed guest worker idea.
How much of the farm work in the second half of the 20th century was done by immigrants from south of the border?
Oh, a huge share. Right now it's about half. Half of undocumented immigrants, half illegal immigrants half of the farm labor are undocumented immigrants, right, you know, these days. And I would say that maybe another, 15%, maybe 20% are immigrants under the current a visa system for temporary workers, which is called the H-2A visa, which has been increasing over the last several years as farmers have moved to employ more Mexican workers through this visa.
During recessions or times of high unemployment, why haven't out-of-work Americans chosen to fill those jobs?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. And my guess is that the wages are too low, and wages in agriculture today are really, really very low.
So rather than take a low-paying job, they'd rather have no job?
Or maybe live on food stamps. Also, there's a question of geographical mobility. So right now, the agricultural economy is, if you think of like San Joaquin Valley in California, where a large share of the produce eaten across the United States come from. That's a very, very heavily Latino population, and very heavily Mexican. And so those are the people who are there to do the work. Now, who do you propose go there, say, from Detroit to an unemployed auto worker from Detroit? The proposition will go to California and earn $12 an hour. Is really not a great proposition, basically. So it's not just a question of, well, the job is I just have to go out the door and get this job. It involves, moving to another part of the country and for a very, very low wage. So, the question about why low-income workers do not take, agricultural jobs or jobs at McDonald's or jobs at 7-Eleven is an interesting question, and I think that all workers, even low-income workers, have a kind of like a floor under which they will not go.
I'm speaking with Eduardo Porter, who writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. His article, A Framework for Managing Immigration, was in the October 26 paper. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Eduardo Porter, who writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. His article, A Framework for Managing Immigration, was in the October 26th edition of the paper. You write that Donald Trump's proposal to end illegal immigration is a fake solution. How is it fake?
Oh, I think it's problematic in many ways. The first thing to say is that I think that the wall idea has already been tried, and it has already failed. I mean, many people don't know, but on a 2,000-mile border, we already have 700 miles of fence. And we have a border patrol that has increased in number of agents and the size of its budget by leaps and bounds over the last 20 years. We have drones, we have sensors under the ground, infrared sensors, and that clearly has not stopped undocumented immigration. So the border patrol budget has increased by a factor by 16 times between 1980 and 2010. And that has really done nothing, or done little, or done not enough at any rate, to suppress unauthorized immigration.
So why do you think the Union for the Border Patrol Agents has come out in support of Donald Trump?
I mean, my guess is that these are the people whose job it is to keep, you know, immigrants out, and they're very frustrated that they can't keep immigrants out. And so anything that increases their, you know, arsenal to keep immigrants out will be welcome. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it will actually work. You know, we've had the idea that enforcement of the border is the solution, that will keep immigration low or cut it down to zero, is not a new idea. It's an idea that has existed since the end of the Bracero program. And it has, you know, to my mind, proven a remarkable failure. So that's sort of like, I kind of think the sweep of my column is that when you're thinking, oh, no, guest workers programs are problematic, which they have been, well, look at what's the counterfactual. The counterfactual, which we've had for a good 50 years now, has been, no, let's cut them off at the border. And it has not worked. It had resulted in enormous deaths of migrants trying to cross through the desert. It has resulted in horrible working conditions for undocumented immigrants in the United States. And it has not increased the wages of in these industries. Right now, farm wages are extremely low compared to wages elsewhere in the economy.
You interviewed Carlos Gutierrez, who served as the Commerce Secretary under George W. Bush. What did he say about the Trump wall?
Well, he basically said in somewhat different words what I just said, that this program has not worked, and that he argues that there's a legitimate need by businesses for, you know, workers, immigrant workers from Mexico, and that seems to me, you know, proven by reality, that there is a demand for this type of worker, and that the enforcement strategy had not worked. And so he was therefore supportive of trying a new guest worker program. But interestingly, this is not just a kind of like a Bush administration flavored idea. The group that put together this proposal,
a blueprint to regulate U.S.-Mexico labor mobility.
Yeah. That includes a former Mexican president. It includes Eliseo Medina, who is of the Service Employees International Union, which is, in fact, the biggest union in the United States. And he is of Latino heritage. He also supported this, as well as, like, folks from the Center of Global Development. So this is not necessarily just a pro-business idea. I think it's an idea that is born from frustrations coming from all sides about how the status quo doesn't work.
David Bacon writes that if we wanted to implement a modern Bracero program today, labor safeguards would be useless because they already exist and are completely ignored.
All right. Well, I mean, I suppose that's a position you can have, that we have labor laws and they're ignored. But, you know, we have the EEOC, we have the Department of Labor, which occasionally sues employers, and sometimes employees win. I mean, there was just a class action against McDonald's that was won by workers over unpaid wages. So I would, you know, disagree on the general comment that our labor laws are ignored by employers.
Skepticism for legal immigration doesn't just come from the right. Aren't some labor unions also against these legal pathways for Mexican immigrants?
Oh, yes. I think that In fact, the stronger opposition to these ideas has traditionally come from the left and from labor. So when, I don't know if you'll remember, back in the administration of George W. Bush, when there was a plan to reform immigration law, a grand bargain in the making that eventually didn't happen, labor was brought in to support the idea of a kind of like big labor, big immigration reform. But so the AFL insisted on a very low a cap for guest workers. Just to recap a little bit, the grand bargain that the Bush administration worked on with Ted Kennedy was we will have a guest worker program, we will have a process to legalize illegal immigrants, and we will have a much more tough set of rules to ensure that employers do not hire illegal immigrants afterwards. So those were the three elements of this. But the guest worker component was actually quite small, was, if I remember correctly, about 100,000. And that was reached also with enormous reluctance by the AFL-CIO. So they were on board, but they were always very wary of this component of the deal.
For many of Trump's supporters, the issue doesn't seem to be about legal versus illegal immigration. It's that resources are being devoted to helping people from a different country at the expense of helping American workers. And there's that whole giver and taker argument that results. Then there's also concern about crime. Are those valid arguments?
I think that the position of Trump voters about immigration is kind of actually difficult to pin down. Actually, some studies, one done by Gallup, another one done by Raul Hinojosa of UCLA, found that actually that voters in zones with high immigration from Mexico were actually not high in support for Donald Trump. So people that were actually close to illegal immigrants were not particularly favorable to Donald Trump or the wall and his proposition. So it's really not clear to me what part of immigration is the one that inspires this support for ideas like the wall. What exactly it is. It seems to be mostly people that do not live in close to immigrants, that in fact that live in enclaves where there are very, very few immigrants, who seem to support Donald Trump the most.
You wrote in an earlier story for the Times that a Trump presidency could result in 37 million fewer people in the United States than a Clinton presidency. All due to illegal immigration?
That's just a kind of like a back of the envelope done by a demographer, Joseph Chami, about, you know, kind of like interpreting the proposals from the Clinton and the Trump campaigns. So basically, he was assuming that Trump manages to stop illegal immigration entirely and to deport the immigrants that are here. And on the Hillary Clinton side, well, she had a plan to offer a path to legal status to the immigrants that were already here. And so he just, like, the difference between those two proposals, you project it down to a certain year, and you got this difference in the population.
You also spoke to Mexico's Secretary of the Economy. What did he have to say about Trump's plan?
About the Trump's wall plan?
Yeah, well, you mentioned an old spat between the U.S. and Mexico over trucks.
Yeah, well, the Secretary of the Economy was more worried about NAFTA than he was worried about the wall. In fact, he quipped that if Donald Trump used cement from the Mexican company Cemex to build the wall, it might actually turn out good for Mexico. He was quite concerned over the prospect that Donald Trump would pull the United States out of NAFTA. And of course, the Mexican economy is very, very dependent on the American economy. I mean, Mexico exports an enormous share of its exports to the United States, and exports are a very large share of its economy. So the fear from the point of view of the Mexican government has to do with that. I think that that Mexicans, and this is kind of like just my interpretation of the body language, are not quite sure that border wall would get built. again, I mean, not only there's the point that I made before that the wall already failed, but there's also the other point that right now net migration from Mexico to the United States is actually negative. So there's more Mexicans leaving the United States than are coming in. So then the point is, well, what's the point of the wall? To keep the ones that are here in the United States? Because that has also been the effect of our efforts to build walls in the past. It has actually trapped more people here that used to go back and forth.
Hasn't Mexico put tariffs on apples and Christmas trees? Why those two products?
You're talking about the truck dispute.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
We were talking about this a little while ago.
Yeah. It's a fun story. So under NAFTA, there was supposed to be an agreement where U.S. trucks could deliver goods into Mexico, wherever they wanted in Mexico, and Mexican trucks could deliver goods wherever they wanted in the United States. And so that they didn't have to unload their stuff at the border and then reload it on an American truck or vice versa. The thing is that right after NAFTA was passed, the U.S. kind of ignored that provision. Under pressure from the Teamsters mainly. And so Mexico didn't do anything immediately. Then it protested before a NAFTA tribunal. It won the case, and then that allowed Mexico to retaliate imposing tariffs for a certain amount of money that had to do with some estimate of the cost of the U.S. not implementing the truck provision. So Mexico, when it finally did decide to retaliate, it chose goods from the states where members of Congress opposed the trucking provision. So it actually targeted the people in Congress that were kind of like blocking the truck exchange, and it proved to be quite effective, because shortly after these tariffs were put in place, well, you had the Christmas tree lobby in Oregon. Mexico imposed a tariff on Christmas trees, and so a lot of Mexico's Christmas trees come from Oregon. And so, well, you had the Oregon Christmas tree lobby, you know, up in arms and arguing that something should be done about the trucks so that Mexico would not punish the Christmas trees. And eventually, a pilot program for Mexican trucks to come into the United States was reinitiated.
Eduardo, we have very little time, but hasn't a catch-22 been suggested? If Trump tries to stop illegal immigration and cut off trade deals, the Mexican government is arguing that it would impoverish Mexico and encourage more illegal immigrants?
Oh, yes, certainly. And it would impoverish the United States. I mean, there's been plenty of analysis of the Trump proposals, and they all are pretty dismal for the U.S. economy.
It's projected that 6 million American jobs would be lost. But we've run out of time, unfortunately. Eduardo, thank you so much for being on our show. Eduardo Porter writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. And his article, A Framework for Managing Immigration, was in the October 26th edition of the New York Times. It's been a fascinating conversation. I thank you again.
Thanks a lot, Leonard. It was fun.